When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, everyone. No new episode this week. We are doing a re-air, which we experimented with during season 4, and it definitely helped us. I think it helped our listeners to understand the show and sort of where it's come from since its beginning. Tommy is from season 2, and that was quite a while ago. That was at the beginning of lockdown and the pandemic, and I was in a different place. Geez, listening to it, and I hear myself, and I'm not going to put you through it. I'm actually cutting out the original intro. If you want to listen to the old episode, you can go down our feed. But I just wanted to tell you that putting together Tommy's episode was such a whirlwind. I can't even tell you what I was even thinking of the time, what I was feeling. I was just losing myself in the story as best as I could, and I think we did a pretty good job. Tommy definitely did a wonderful reading, and we hope you enjoy it. Sorry there's no new episode this week. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Storybound. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy.
On my days off, I walk the narrow blacktop roads of an area called Diamond 20 in the small town of Copperopolis. We're in the foothills of the Sierras now, just barely still in what can be considered Northern California. The sun's right above me, pressing on the back of my neck. I reach back and cover it, keep my hand there. It's the middle of the day in the middle of the summer, which out here means it's hot as hell. I'm just coming back from one, a hell. Or I'm still in one and I've gotten so used to it I started calling it something else. No, this isn't hell. It's just fucking hot. The heat here is dry and mean and everywhere. It crushes, seeps, floats up in waves like smoke from the pavement. Gets into the brain. Slows thinking. I pass under the shade of an oak and look down at my shadow, which is joined by the shadow of a tree. So mangled by or mingled with branch shadows, it becomes a new thing. The shadowed object, like and not like me or the tree. The blending of images only possible where light can't be. The shine of gold and tall dead grass makes me think of the people who came to these hills for gold. The rush to get to it. And then thinking of that time, thinking of those miners, makes me think of Indians, who would have been here and been seen as in the way. I'm thinking of native people here because I am one. Not full blood, but enough. We natives are always looking for our presence in the absences. I look up on my phone whether there were ever Native Americans in Copperopolis. There's a small entry on an abandoned website about signs of human settlement dating 10,000 years back. Human remnants, it says. This makes me think of remains and how we use that word to describe people who haven't remained at all, but left what time didn't get at all the way. I look up as if to get out of the gloom of that thought and see turkey vultures circling what must be something dead or dying nearby. I think about how things must stink worse in the heat. There's a big field of tall dead grass the vultures are circling above. The stalks of yellow move a little from a hot wind that, instead of cooling me, just reminds me of how hot the heat is. I find that I'm swaying a little like the grass. I look down and watch my mangled shadow sway. My 4-year-old son, Alex, isn't old enough to know how to be afraid of me the way the rest of my family is afraid of me. He still runs up to me when I come home, and I bend down and he holds my big head in his arms. He's just learned to say, "I love you." He knows what it means to say it and uses it sparingly so that it keeps its meaning. As for my ever-understanding wife, Anne, we haven't talked about what happened very much because when we've tried, something between us opens up too wide for us to know how to speak across it. My mother and father-in-law and my sister-in-law and her 2 girls, they either talk about me like I'm not there or they don't talk about me at all. Never mind talk to me. I'm a haunt they're afraid to be afraid of in front of because of what it might do to me. I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to talk to me either. I'd tried for a voluntary exit before my time had come with a razor. Voluntary exit is too clinical or noble sounding, a euphemism here, of course. Before my time had come isn't right either. Time and its length, the one we're given, is an elusive thing. There are exits everywhere for those of us who, actively or not, look for them. A train or approaching bus, 22 too many drinks, a sharp object, anywhere. Much less common are entrances, ways in. Like the day we had our son. There in the hospital on my knees holding the bed rail and listening to the machines and my wife's breathing. There was paper constantly being printed out that showed the contractions, their size and length, like we were measuring earthquakes. There was something that made sense to me about how acute the pain seemed to be for my wife. Why that was part of birth, like a blow to the body from within, a magical wound from which a human boy came out. Things were good for the first several years of his life. Everything he did was a miracle. Sure, he was incapable, a mouth. But I didn't know what love was before he came. Not that kind of love, anyway. Before Copperopolis, those first few years after he was born, I was still telling people I was a poet. And then, to the expected follow-up question, "No, but what do you do for a living?" I'd say, "Videographer." Which wasn't a lie, but it wasn't exactly true either. I hardly made a living at it. I've been ready to sign a significant contract with a native nonprofit to produce promotional videos for their website. Then that job and a psychotherapist position my wife had lined up at the same organization fell through at the last minute after a sudden tribal leadership change. When we moved in with my wife's family in Copperopolis, I'd just been released from the hospital after going at my left wrist with a razor in the bathroom I was supposed to be cleaning in order to move out of our house in Oakland. I'd thought about suicide plenty before trying it, as it goes. It was the razor's angle in the bathroom, that little blade on the sink, square and flat against it like a self-destruct button I just then realized I could press. So I pressed it in deep, then across. A dark purple circle appeared in the middle of my vision as I went to the ground. Later, that spot would return, only white and not dark purple. The bright white of stars, away from cities, in a new moon sky. Or like the sun looks with your eyes closed after having stared at it too long. When I was on the way to the hospital, I felt untouched by the dark purple spot, and yet maybe about to enter it at the same time, levitating above its grasp, its gravity. When my wife found me on the bathroom floor, she told her mom, who was there to help us clean and move out, to take our son for a walk in his stroller. It was time for his nap anyway. The ambulance ride seemed buoyant to the point of pleasant before I passed out from losing too much blood. I don't remember any of what happened in the hospital. When I came to, my wife was rolling me out to the parking lot in a wheelchair. I felt refreshed, born again, as if into a new life. I got a job as a sandwich artist at the local Subway. It's the first time I'm being paid and acknowledged as an artist. The Subway is in a sort of shopping complex designed to look like an old-fashioned town, like maybe from the 50s. Except everything looks brand new. There's a giant clock tower in the center of the town square everyone calls New Old Town. I've recently taken to sucking on pennies and contemplating bank robbery. The pennies because there was an especially shiny brand new one out of a roll I broke to make smaller change for an impatient man with a sandwich I'd just made in his hand, lightly slapping the sandwich against his palm like a cop's baton. As he left, I popped the penny in my mouth and sucked on it. It didn't taste like I thought it would. It tasted good to me. Thoughts of robbing the local bank came to me after I made a cash drop for the first time the other day and noticed there was no bulletproof glass between the customer and the teller. I didn't know they still had banks like that. Robbing a bank didn't seem crazy when I thought about it. It seemed reasonable. I need to provide for my family more than I need the discounted sandwiches and day-old cookies I get to take home for free. My son loves the cookies and says it wrong. Like the Cookie Monster says his own name wrong on Sesame Street. Cookie. 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 In the new life, everything seems allowable. The star white hole is there every time I close my eyes. I've started to think of it as a cell. I've been thinking if I could split the cell, something important might happen. I close my eyes more now, fascinated by the details I can sometimes make out inside the hole. It sort of shimmers at its edges. Or the edges blur if I stare too long, like it's reacting to my staring at it. My coworker, Sam, caught me with my eyes closed and accused me of sleeping on the job. Late night, he said, smiling and lifting his eyebrows like people do to suggest you got into trouble or something. No, I started. He was laughing. I get headaches and it helps when I clench my eyes shut. Oh, he said, his smile gone. He went to the back to make more bread. I'd requested for my green name tag to say Thomas, which is my author name, Thomas Blaine. But my manager told me they, Subway, like to use shorter names on name tags. So it says Tom on my name tag. I didn't know if this was to save money on letters or because shorter names indicate a casual kind of friendliness and familiarity. Do I take putting sandwiches together as seriously as I do my poems? The scaffolding is similar. You begin the build in order to begin to build the order. What kind of bread? Toasted? No two sandwich orders are the same. Variance is the constant. Of course, poems aren't asked for or ordered. And how do you build a life My life had felt like it was building to something that came apart, which I'm now attempting to rebuild behind sneeze guard glass.
You are listening to Storybound. And now for a short break.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now we return from our break.
I'm lying in bed awake because I can't sleep. It's too hot. There's no AC here. It doesn't cool down at night at this point in the summer. I'm with my wife and son. We just have a sheet over us. I think they're asleep, but then hear them both shift in bed in a way that feels to me like they're awake. I don't know, though, and don't want to wake them if they're asleep. They might be awake thinking the same of me. "Tom," my wife says. She can always tell when I'm awake. "You can't sleep either," I whisper. "It's that damn fly," she says, with a real, actual hatred in her voice. I haven't noticed the fly. "Me too, Mama," our son says. So he's been awake too. All of us lying there, in silence. Something about it is so sweet and sad at the same time. I start crying without meaning to. "What happened to Dada?" our son asks his mom. "I don't know. Maybe he really loves flies," Anne jokes. And this makes the boy laugh harder than I'd have expected. We all laugh, and Anne gets up and turns on the light, carefully stepping around the room, listening and looking for where the fly might land. I wipe my tears and sit up, looking for the fly too. "There," the boy shouts, and points to the mirror, where half a dozen flies are squashed from earlier in the day. My wife is an excellent fly hunter. You have to be still, then swift, without hesitation. She gets the thing, and it doesn't squish, but gets knocked against the glass, then falls to the ground. She steps on it, and I see the boy, in my periphery, look at me for a reaction to the death of the fly. "It's okay, Dada," he says. "Flies don't live long anyway." I smile at him in a way that tells him I'm not sad about the fly. It goes silent after that. Something about not living long anyway. Something about it being okay to die because of a shorter life makes me and his mom remember. I look up on the internet how to rob a bank without a gun. I watch a YouTube clip about a guy who robbed 20 banks by just writing a note, and learn that bank policy requires that they give over the money, be compliant, no questions asked, even if no gun is present. I write several drafts of the kind of note I might write. "This is a bank robbery. Put $10,000 in the bag and no one gets hurt." I analyze the note, wonder at its faults. I want it to be plain and clear what is happening and how much money I need. But this, "no one gets hurt," there's something beautiful about the idea of no one getting hurt. Also delusional. I want to strike that part of the robbery note and save it for a future poem called "No One Gets Hurt." "This is a robbery. Put $10,000 in the bag, or else. I can't help but question this or else. The threat, as vague as it is, trite. And this else isn't specific enough. Else can be so much else. Do I need to declare this a robbery? I research more about bank policies and gunless robberies. There's a strict adherence to nonviolence being the most important possible outcome, even if no gun is present. Sometimes customers don't even know what is happening while a robbery is happening. Bank policy and training ensures there is no scene or risk-taking. I need brevity and clarity. I'll shoot if you don't give me 10,000. I read the finalized note out loud. I'll shoot if you don't give me 10,000. It's terrible. It's the night before I'm going to attempt the robbery. We're all eating dinner together. Someone's put on old-sounding country or bluegrass. The way everyone is smiling at first makes me suspicious, like they're trying to make me feel better. We're having homemade Chinese food. Anne's dad is Chinese, grew up in Hong Kong. The kids are all laughing at something on YouTube. Anne's parents are in the kitchen. She catches my eye and smiles at me in a way that we sometimes smile at each other to say I love you without having to say it. We clink our glasses of rosé. When she gets up to go help in the kitchen, I wonder about whether maybe I was making it up all along, that they didn't want to talk to me, or that they think I'm too fragile. Maybe it's just that we're new to living together in the same space. They've let us stay here in their home. They cook and clean for us. The feeling doesn't last. Clarity never does. I go back to thinking about the money, what it could mean. I never consider jail time or getting caught. My plan is to say it was for a book of poems I'm working on. I'll tell them I was researching. I've even written some poems to show as proof alongside my notes for the robbery. The book will be about stealing and greed and hunger for gold, about how this whole country is based on theft of land and how much that all has to do with this region, this gold country. I can't sleep again. Alex and Anne fell asleep watching a movie out in the living room. My eyes are closed. I stare at the white light. Figures and shapes start to appear inside it, and I wonder if this is me falling asleep or getting a deeper understanding of the hole's insides. Had I torn something open in me? Stared at a strange star too long? While I was wherever you go, that memory can't come back from? In the hospital? After losing all that blood? I clench my eyes tighter, and what's inside the hole is the hospital room. It's Alex and Anne playing in the chair next to my hospital bed. They're playing a game where he hides something and she pretends not to know where it could possibly be. It's the game where he tells her it's magic, with a mischievous smile like we both know it's not, but let's pretend you don't know. The rest of the family comes into the room. Everyone we're living with now, everyone I thought forgot about me. I feel stupid and selfish. I try to focus harder on the hole, see the scene, but just as I do, it all goes away and the hole is just white again. My wife comes in carrying our son. He's asleep. She lays him down between us. I was going to do something really stupid, I say. And there's a pause. She's wondering if I mean something else. Do something really stupid again. She's wondering if she even wants to have this conversation. What am I asking her to carry? It's not that, I say. What then? It's nothing. What? I'm not going, I say. You're not going to what? I said I'm not going, I say, to do something stupid. I mean, I'm sure I will. But not that again. No. Good, she says, We need you here. What are we gonna do, I say. Things will change. They always do, she says. Not all change is good. Well, when it seems it can't get worse, the odds are better. True. Let's get some sleep. Do you ever see the image of the sun when you close your eyes, even if you didn't look at the sun? What are you talking about? You mean like the floaty things you see when you close your eyes too tight or jam your fists into your eyes? No, this doesn't float. It stays right in the middle. In the middle. Yes. Okay, well, you can go up to the Indian clinic if you're worried about it. I'm not worried. Well, maybe you should be. Thanks. I'm kidding. I was gonna rob the bank. What? With a note. You're tired, Anne says. I couldn't get it right. Everything I wrote down was awful, I say. You've been writing again? I guess I have.
This story, titled Copperopolis, was written and performed by Tommy Orange, first published in Freeman's, California. The musical score for this episode was composed by Ryan Dan of Holland Patent Library. Make sure you check out the original comic for this episode, drawn by Shane Milner, which is now available on our Instagram and Twitter at StoryboundPod. We would also like to thank Maya Solovia for her scheduling assistance, as well as Tim Carplus for mixing this episode. Storybound is arranged, produced, and hosted by me, Jude Brewer. Our executive producers are Jeff Umbro of the Podglomerate and Justin Alvarez of LitHub. This show's theme was developed by Grain Table, and thank you to Modestus Mankus for this outro sample. You want to tell us what you think of the show? Well, you can find us on Twitter at StoryboundPod, or you can tweet at me directly at Jude Brewery. New episodes are released every Tuesday. Next week, we'll hear a story from Lauren Groff. And before we close out, I would like to share a passage of something that, this was written during a time to comfort a friend who was going through a great deal of mental duress. So, here it is. Isn't it interesting to think that you can be having the worst day of your life while someone else is having their best? And just think, how wild is it if that other person, that someone else, is also you? You can be staring in the mirror, contemplating on ending your life. Meanwhile, you are also staring in the mirror in disbelief at how rich and how joyful your life feels. It's like the morning after a terrible event, where you ask yourself, did that really happen? Only now you are simultaneously experiencing both, but you aren't feeling both. It's more like sitting in the middle of a long, dark tunnel with no light at the end, wondering if you keep walking, will it eventually appear? And there's a version of you that's already seen the light, or in the light, like living in different time zones, because the night is coming for us now, but it's already left those on the other side of this planet. They're living tomorrow, while we are still facing today. Maybe it's best to think of ourselves as little planets, passing through our seasons, because there's only one way to get to spring, and that's through a harsh winter, a mild fall, a dry, relentless summer. We would love it to be cool and sunny and fresh and green all the time, but you can't have the green without the gray. You cannot suffer loss if you do not know the joy of having everything you could ask for. You cannot live without having not lived for most of eternity. But even as we are not living, there is a version of ourselves still very much alive. We are never gone completely. We are simply here and there all the time. Thank you again for listening this week, and we hope to see you next week. Take care of yourselves until then.
The Podglomerate, a Sonic Universe.